Okay, so I'm Rick Hansen, and I always forget the date. It's the 18th? 17th. Nice prime number, 17th of September 2014. And I want to try to put together two things and see what you think about it. So I want to, first of all, start, with a quotation from Ajahn Chah. Ajahn is an honorific, like rabbi or sister, what have you. Chah, he's a Thai teacher, no longer alive. He's probably the major teacher for Jack Kornfield and a number of other people in the stream of Buddhism that's come into the West. And I find for myself that just about anything he writes, which are typically transcriptions of his talks, very informal talks, he's really down to earth and very much worth paying attention to. So there's a little passage here. He says basically, the Buddha told us to see the way things are and then let go of clinging to them. That's pretty summary. Ajahn Chah lived in a rural setting. Most of the people he spoke with were the local farmers, the ordinary people, as well as the monastics around him. But he's very down to earth, very direct. So as he says again, the Buddha told us to see the way things are and then let go of our clinging to them. Take this feeling of letting go as your refuge. This feeling of letting go as your refuge. You have to know what that feeling is, the feeling of letting go, taking it as your refuge. So the question is, of course, how to actually do that. And Buddhism, especially the kind of original, early, northern India, Theravadan strand of Buddhism that's close to the Buddhism teachings, tends to engage this letting go in two kinds of ways. The first way is a lot about insight into the nature of things. See their impermanence, see their compounded nature, see their selflessness. Okay, that's one side. The other way is more of a bottom-up approach that's really embedded in the Four Noble Truths, especially the second and the third, which are, in effect, a drive theory, if you have any sense of that in terms of psychology. In other words, we have in the second noble truth the idea that we're disturbed in some way, so we crave, right? And then in the third noble truth, there's the possibility of the end of that sense of deficit or disturbance, and therefore the end of the craving. So we get to letting go that way. So I want to kind of slow it down and unpack those two things. So in the first way to letting go, you could say the way of insight, we take our own experience and we explore it. So I want to invite you to do this right now as I talk about this. So here we are. We're hearing. There is hearing. There is seeing, right? There is thinking. There is emotion. There is desire. There is sensation. That's all true. And there is awareness, certainly, isn't there? So we have right there the realm of experience, or in fancy language, the realm of phenomenology. Okay. And lately, I just want to share with you a kind of perspective I've been having on my own phenomenology and that of other people, is how weird it is. And I want to explain what I mean by that term. Because if you think about it, we take what it feels like to sense the weight, of the chair against us, or what it's like to see something, like what a sight is like, or perhaps we close our eyes and we recall something, what a memory is like. We take it for granted, don't we? Except that experience, clearly we now know, is the product of 600 million years of pretty arbitrary evolution in the nervous system. And we have kind of the residues inside our own psyche of the experiences of worms and crabs and frogs and lizards and rats and birds and, monkeys and hominids and Stone Age people, right? And so, in other words, our experience that we hold so dear to ourselves is arbitrarily constructed. It's arbitrary. It's not this way because it has to be this way or because someone designed it to be this way. It's just kind of cobbled together based on, the physical properties of the nervous system and the survival requirements of our ancient ancestors, including early humans. And like you can think about that intellectually, or you can also recognize, wow, that's actually weirdly true. This experience, this sense of ongoingness, of me-ness, very loosely defined, is incredibly arbitrarily constructed. And when you do that, it's weirdly dislocating. You suddenly realize that you've been watching this movie your entire life and thinking that it was sensible and ordinary and of course, and you suddenly realize it's completely made up. It's just completely made up. So that's kind of an entry into recognizing the nature of experience and becoming increasingly disenchanted, waking up from the spell. All right, so we look at our experience, and what do we see? As the Buddha taught, we see first that it's continually changing, has a kind of instability to it, which we now know in terms of the underlying neurology, you know, what's happening in the brain and the nervous system and the body, is this very ongoing dynamic process of coalitions of synapses forming, coming together, very unstable, molecularly dynamic, even at the level of the synapses. It's all changing. And that underlying process of gooey ferment, right, in the brain is the basis for that ongoing kind of dynamic, fizzing, unstable, transient quality to our experiences. Second, as the Buddha pointed out, this realm of experience seems made up of many parts, and the more you drill down into it, the more granular it seems to get. And so you can start seeing that it's kind of built out of these little parts. This part is seeing, this part is the feeling I have about whatever I see. This part is the desire I have related to how I feel about whatever I see. This part is the commentary about da 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 da. And it's all these parts. So you see the compounded nature of it. And in that dynamic and compounded process, which is constructed due, and its very nature, the feeling of being, the feeling of sensing, the feeling of hearing, is arbitrarily constructed through the lives and deaths of billions, probably trillions and trillions and trillions of creatures with a nervous system. And when you look at it like that, you can't find an owner. You can't find an architect. There's no screenwriter for the movie. There's no director, right? There are these various characters in the mind you think they're so important, all these various sub-personalities yapping away. And yet their yapping is kind of robotically unfolding based on countless processes kind of flowing through us, this vast sort of wave made up of many parts that we're all riding. Like, that may seem like really lofty or fancy. That's how it is. At least my view, see for yourself, but that is the nature of experience. And when we come kind of close into it in that way, as the Buddha taught, it's harder and harder to take it too seriously, which moves us to that letting go. That's kind of like the path of insight. It's sort of a top-down path. It's analytic, somewhat conceptual, especially in the beginning as a map, and then you peer more and more closely into the nature of your own experience as a path to, or as a means to the end of increasingly letting go. Okay so far? So that's a lot of the way Dharma's taught. That's a lot of what practice is about in a nutshell. But I want to do a little thought experiment with you that is not a thought experiment, it's a real experiment. And don't do this if you have any issues with what I'm about to describe, which will be clear in a moment. So I'm going to invite you in a moment with me to take a big breath and hold it. And I invite you, not yet, we're getting ready. So if you have any issues around trauma or asthma, don't do this. You know, think happy thoughts. It's our daughter's best friend, send her to her junior high. Laurel, remember your happy place. Okay, so whatever your happy place is. But otherwise, so what I'm going to invite you to do is take a breath and hold it and then observe your experience. Observe its transience. Observe its compoundedness. Observe its ownerlessness, its selflessness. And then when you finally need to, take a breath. Okay? And then we'll talk about it. So here we go. Ready? Eyes open or closed. Take a breath and with me. And this is not a contest. There's no comparing. You don't have to outlast me, you know, or whatever or not. Okay, ready? Here we go. This is an experiment. You're observing your own experience. Take a breath, hold it. Don't exhale. Notice the changing nature of your experience. Many parts. And when you want or need to, inhale. The reason I did this, and I did it myself earlier, kind of extensively, and it's very interesting to explore. You know, in the beginning, you're looking at your experience, and it's kind of peaceful. And then the anxiety starts to increase, right? And you can still regard your experience in this kind of insightful way. You can see the way in which it's kind of fizzing and dynamic and changing, and that it's insubstantial. Your experience is insubstantial. You can't touch it, right? You can't weigh an idea or a sound or a memory. But at some point, if we truly want to be at peace, we need to inhale. We need to breathe. We need to exhale and breathe, right? And so now I want to talk more of the bottom-up side of things. Because I think in practice, to truly do what Ajahn Chah is talking about, you know, letting go and taking refuge in the feeling in letting go, we need to also recognize our animal nature and our needs as animals. And you may know from reading things I've written or listening to me before that fundamentally I think we have three core needs for safety, satisfaction, and connection as umbrella terms that are loosely linked to the reptilian brainstem, mammalian subcortex, and primate human cortex stages of evolution, very loosely, okay? So we have these three core needs. And when we don't experience in our core that our needs are met, that naturally creates a drive state in which we feel a sense of deficit or disturbance, which causes craving, which then leads to suffering and harm. Okay so far? So one way to let go is, in addition to a kind of detached, impersonal, generic recognition of mind, transient, passing, compounded, insubstantial, you know, ownerless, selfless. Can't find a self. You can find thoughts of self. You can never find that which those thoughts refer to as an intact, unified owner of experiences and agent of actions, right? We can look at it, we can look at mind that way generically. That's kind of top down. It's important. And simultaneously, we can really serve ourselves by registering again and again and again the feeling of I'm safe enough right now. I'm satisfied, I'm contented, I'm full enough, I'm rewarded enough, I'm accomplished enough right now. So if we feel safe enough right now, I'm not being eaten by a shark in this moment, right? I'm not being invaded by some threat, right now at least, I can let go of resisting things that are unpleasant. I can let go of habit patterns of craving around defending myself and bracing, right? And ruminating and worrying. I can let go in that way, right? Because at least in that moment, I feel safe enough. Similarly, in terms of satisfaction or approaching rewards, if I feel in this moment, you know, like the fullness of the moment, the amazingness of being here, just the enoughness, the having arrived enough already, you know, there is enough. If I can feel that, again, there's a letting go, you know, of the drivenness around chasing after what's pleasant, right? Grasping after it. And in the same way, if in this moment you feel connected enough, loved enough, liked enough. It'd be nice to have more, but basically an enoughness there, recognized enough already, you know, valued and appreciated enough already. In touch with your own lovingness, with imperfect relationships. Perfect love, as John Wellwood puts it, imperfect relationships. When we feel that, right there, whoosh, there's a letting go. So you see the two paths, in effect. One is a kind of generic path of insight that takes mind qua mind, mind as mind. It's very nature. What is the nature of this mind process unfolding before us? And as we understand it and recognize its nature more and more deeply, we become freer of it. But I don't think that's enough. Maybe it's enough if you're in a monastic setting and you can practice 24 hours a day and you have intense concentration and you've deeply trained yourself, it might be enough. But I think for me, honestly, and most people, especially householders living an active life, it's not enough. What we also need to do is to respect what the poet Mary Oliver called the soft animal of the body. To respect that little lizard, that little mouse, and that little monkey inside us all. To respect what, I mean, you can have, you, to respect what it is to not breathe, right? And so the opportunity then, and then I'm curious what you think about all this, the opportunity is to recognize the nature of mind as mind, you know, so forth, and use that as a path into letting go. Because you realize, wow, why am I getting so uptight about these arbitrary phantasms, like movie images, hallucinations kind of, flickering through this mind? Okay, that's one way. The other way is again and again and again to really register it when you have a felt sense of peace. You're at peace with life, not at war with it, safe enough at peace. And to really register it when there's an opportunity for contentment, that there's a fullness, enough has happened already. You know, it'd be nice to aim for the next thing, dream the next dream, fine, but without a sense of drivenness about it. And then also, can you register feeling loved enough and feeling loving enough yourself? And I find that people vary, by the way, to finish up here, in which one of those three, the lizard, the mouse, and the monkey, you know, has the most action going on with it? Where are the issues? You know, for myself, just recently in my own exploration of this material, I realized that my current big issues were in the contentment system. They were in approaching rewards, that I don't feel particularly threatened. I feel really quite strong and willing for things ultimately to fall apart, as everything always does. So I'm not panicked about that, right? Also, I do feel very nourished, loved by my wife, connected with my kids, you know, a lot of nice people like you, you know, come listen to me once a week. That's pretty good. So, you know, like that was my main issue in life. That was where my hole was in the heart around that. And that's been really healed for me. But I began to realize that I have this habit, kind of like a habit pattern of driving for the next goal, finish the next task, you know, get the next accomplishment done, lay the next brick in some edifice I'm trying to build, whatever. And I realized, wait a second, Rick, that's where my issues were. You know, to really register again and again a sense of completion around contentment. So I invite you to look for yourself, these days especially, where it would really serve you to internalize authentically based beneficial experiences to undo the underlying sense of deficit or disturbance that's driving your personal particular flavor of craving. Okay. So you see the basic package, kind of top-down, generic overview, bottom-up, repeated internalization. And to finish, as we do have these opportunities, moments of recognition of the nature of mind or the felt sense of enough safety and peace, enough satisfaction and contentment, enough connection and love, to really register it. And as we register it, let letting go increasingly become the habit of our lives. That's kind of an overview, and I wondered what you thought about it. Great.
I just have a question, actually, but But what does refuge actually mean when you say let go and take refuge in the letting go?
Yeah.
Is that what the contentment is?
So you're asking, what is refuge? What does that word mean, right? And then how would taking refuge in letting go, the feeling of letting go, as Ajahn Chah says, how would that work? So I think of refuge, honestly, as like kids, home base. As long as I'm touching the tree, you can't make me it, you know, right? It's a refuge. It's like, this is my safe place. Or I was at a friend's house recently, had a little baby born, and the big sister, all of 2 and a half, we were hanging out, and I said, hey, you want to show me your bedroom, right? Part to give her mom a bit of a break. And she ran off, showed me her bedroom, and she showed me her little bed. She's so happy about her bed. She jumps in it, she shows me the stuff in it. That's her refuge in a real way. So, you know, and then there are other kinds of refuge too, where what protects us? Where do we feel protected, you know? And where do we feel fed, right? Fed and protected, maybe also inspired, right? So that's the nature of refuge. And it's interesting to reflect, how would the feeling of letting go be a refuge? And to be clear, as soon as we conceptualize it, oh, I'm letting go. This is what letting go is like. That's so interesting. That's nice. There's a place for that. But you notice, as soon as you do that, you're out of the refuge. You're looking back at it like, whoa, that was a cool refuge, but you're no longer in it, you know. That's the way I would put it. And so, yeah, and so it's so much about again and again registering these useful experiences so increasingly they become our habit. And registering means you're actually changing your brain a little bit. And that way of being becomes more and more consolidated, becomes more and more the habit of your life. Yeah. Please, yeah.
I'm trying to fit this in with the split I seem to have with Buddhism and spirituality. And when you introduced that whole idea of that we grew up in the jungle and we're all basically afraid for the lion at first and now each other. And I felt more compassion for myself and for others. But at the same time, when I love myself, you know, and forgive myself and not blame myself for everything, I feel that's spiritual. I feel that's a spiritual place. And when I rise above, you know, my fear, I feel that's the God mystery in me that's making this possible. And I sort of split with also that it's arbitrary. I feel that there's a plan.
And
I'm not sure that Buddhism feels that way at all. In fact, I've never asked because I'm so respectful of it.
Sure.
And agree with so much of it. But there's one part there that disturbs me about not recognizing that there is a plan. And am I screwed up about it?
Okay.
I don't think so.
No. Well.
What do you think?
Well, a couple of things. So first, you know what it's like. Like, know what it's like to do this, right? This is how we usually live. And then know what it's like to let go, right? And so that's the letting go. Know what that's like. Know what it's like to not have craving present. We're not at war with what's unpleasant. We're not driven toward getting some pleasant reward. And we're not, you know, clinging to other people and our stuff about other people. What's that like? You know, what's it like when it kind of falls away? And become increasingly familiar with that place. Right? I think that minimally, that place is very natural to us. We all know how to let go, right? Story, I don't know if it's true, but it's a heck of a good story. I think it's true. I've done a lot of rock climbing, you may know, and a fellow was climbing on El Capitan, over half a mile high, 3,000-ish plus feet high, and he rappelled. He was sliding down his rope, and he forgot to tie a knot in the end. And he rappelled off the end of his rope at 2,000 feet up, let's say. Just imagine for a moment. And so I wasn't there, but I heard about it, and people said that initially he panicked, of course. For the first few seconds, he was like screaming and trying to walk in air. You can't really do that. And then what it was said was that he just stopped. He was like writhing, trying to catch himself. And then he just stopped, and he opened out and was quiet, as if, you know, as if he didn't want to spend the last 10 seconds of his life panicking. He was a letting go. So, you know, that's pretty extreme, isn't it? But I think there is a kind of letting go in us. So know what that's like. Minimally, that's a natural process, tracking the feeling. And for me, a lot more and more, I'm very interested in what it's like to be in this world fully engaged while letting go. You know, presence and passing away. Presence and passing away, like I said in the meditation instructions. Then it is true, isn't it, that some people, I think you as well, when they really open out, when they really go into that letting go, it starts feeling like there's more going on here than just neurons firing and, you know, molecules moving around. There's some sense that we're connected in some way with something greater than ourselves.
In a mystery.
Yeah. And I personally think, you know, for the record, that first, when we do that, it's like the deep nature of things. That psychological letting go is like the underlying nature, which is endlessly transient, right? And so it gives us a kind of intuition as to what the deep nature of things is. It's not direct contact in itself with the deep nature of things, but it's like it. It's a reminder of it. See the distinction I'm making? And that's my personal opinion. And then in addition to that, my personal opinion is that when we are in that letting go place, we're not so contracted, right, and caught up in parts. Because any kind of craving, if you think about it, is parts entangled with parts. The part that we want, and then the part that wants it, and then the part that's commenting on the whole process, and then the part that's commenting on the commenting, and round and round we go. But when we really let go, we open out. And I think as we do that, we have more accessibility to the underlying nature of everything. You know, the underlying unconditionality, call it the divine something. And meanwhile, most of the time, it's pretty obvious. Is it this or that? You know what I mean? And I really invite you to look for yourself, to, again, bring it down to earth. You know, what's your capacity to just sort of recognize mind as mind, rolling along? Think of it as minding more and more, right? And second, from the more the bottom up, what's your relationship with that little animal? You know? Can you let it land again and again and again when you really have the opportunity, safe enough right now? Right? Can you let it land again and again, full enough right now? Enough good things. Can be at ease, right? Can you let it land again and again, loved and loving, loved and loving? And then let that sense of letting go that comes when we feel, you know, peace, contentment, and love, let that sense of letting go be really registered so it becomes increasingly the habit of your life. Last person, then we'll wrap up.
So I listened to your talk on Saturday a little bit, and you used the A word to get assertiveness.
Oh.
And I was wondering, because the combination of forgiveness and assertiveness, if that's a really great way to let things go. And if you might comment on that.
The combination of something and assertiveness?
Forgiveness and assertiveness.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, that. Yeah. Well, before I do that, I just want, again, it's up to you all, wherever you want to do with this. But, like, we have so many moments where we're not contracted. You know, we're just kind of sitting there and reaching for the salt, right? Or I think bathrooms are a fantastic opportunity for Dharma practice, because there we are, everything's just fine, usually, you know, and wow. Or there you are, you're kind of crawling into bed, and you know, or you're at the end of a meal, right? Or you're just breathing, right? We have so many little moments where we're in the third noble truth instead of the second one. We're not particularly caught up in craving or drivenness, contraction. We're not angry or greedy or deluded. And there also are things we can do to really deepen our sense and the richness of these experiences of no basis for craving. And I just think under our nose many times a day is an opportunity to really register these experiences and increasingly make them our home base. So that's more, because that's our true home base, right? So I really invite you to do that, to look for those opportunities. No basis for craving. Safe enough, full enough, loved enough. Now. And now and now and now. Right? So then as to forgiveness and assertiveness, just kind of briefly, I think with other people, there's this sweet spot, right, where we let go while also being willing to see the truth. And I'll just maybe finish with three words from the Buddha that I've thought about fairly often, that a wise person is one who is peaceable, friendly, and fearless. And if you think about forgiveness and assertiveness, in a way, at the core of each one of them is a different kind of fearlessness in a really healthy way. Peaceable, friendly, and fearless. And we all keep letting go. Let's just sit for a moment and then we'll finish up. It's like, oh, another way of putting it is recognizing when it's true, when it's authentically within reach for you, in terms of those three core needs, safety, satisfaction, connection, it's feeling, even sometimes with saying to yourself, I don't have to be afraid right now. I may need to be afraid in the future, or I may have needed to be afraid in the past, but in this moment, I don't have to be afraid right now. Similarly, I don't have to be frustrated right now. I don't have to be, really. And I don't have to be hurt right now. It doesn't mean lying about your experience. It just means when it's true, when the conditions are present, I don't have to be afraid. I don't have to be frustrated. I don't have to feel hurt. And other similar words, perhaps, in those three categories that might be meaningful to you. Thanks so much for coming. Take good care.
Thank you.
Refuge in letting go.